Part 3 Chapter 14 Pacific Heights. The West is both a great thirst and a dry, weatherless curiosity. In California, the mad, deep breath of deserts is never far away. The sky above San Francisco is often so dazzling a blue that it merits the overripe description of cerulean, or comparison to lapis lazuli. Its clouds are seaborne and formed in the odd depths of its mysterious bay, where the fog moves inland in a billion-celled, mindless creature, amoeba-shaped and poisonous, like a stillborn member of the nightshade family. Southern fogs calm me as they paint the marshes with their milk-stained fingers. The San Francisco fog is a silver-lined hunter of the predator class, and I always find it troubling. When I awaken to its foghorns, they sound like the exiled whimpering of a city in endless sexual distress. As a Charlestonian, I know I am not supposed to bend a knee in admiration of a hill country of such amazing, brittle wildness. But San Francisco seduced me on my first visit to Trevor Poe's flat on Union Street. In its profusion of roses and eucalyptus and palms, the city seems voluptuous and decadent in its very pores, a place that revels in folly and rolls around in the carcasses of human vice. The whole place feels graded, uplifted, maxed out. The views are all spectacular and aha-inducing. San Francisco is a city that requires a fine pair of legs, a city of cliffs misnamed as hills, honeycombed with a fine webbing of showy houses that cling to the slanted streets with the fierceness of abalones. You can spot a whale sounding in the waters between the Presidio and Sausalito in the morning. Buy a live eel for lunch in Chinatown. See the Shakespeare Garden at Golden Gate Park in mid-afternoon. Catch a wave in the Pacific along the Great Highway. Inhale the unforgettable farts of sea lions on Pier 39. Catch part of a gay lesbian film festival at the Castro Theater. Get a book signed by Lawrence Ferlinghetti at City Lights Books. Buy a drink at the Top of the Mark. Trevor Poe gave us this astonishing city as a gift, once he abandoned us to our less glitzy lives in Charleston. His place on Union Street served as a home away from home for all of us, a vacation wonderland. He opened his doors to us and proved an indefatigable lover and sightseer of his adopted city. So it feels like a homecoming to us as the jet lands in Oakland and a limousine transports us to the mansion on Vallejo Street, owned by the producer, a man named Saul Marks, which he has offered to Sheba in her search for her twin. The house is Italianate, with a view of the bay, the Golden Gate Bridge, Sausalito, and the white linen majesty of the city itself. The laconic Irish chauffeur tells us to call him Murray. "What did you have to do to get the producer to give you this house?" Betty asks Sheba, whistling as Murray helps us get our luggage inside the ornate entryway. "I had to play with his little weenie," Sheba replies. She gives Murray a lavish tip, then directs us to our various bedrooms. She apologizes as she sends me down into the entrails of the house, where I have a bedroom without windows, then says, "I've ordered some Chinese. Meet up in the dining room after you unpack." When I make my way upstairs, I find my noisy group of friends gathered in front of a massive window, watching the sunset against a cloudless Pacific in a wilderness of blue. The sun blisters the waters with a seething gold, then a flare of red, followed by a pink-fingered, rosy exit left. Betty says, "Sunsets make me believe in God." Molly adds, "They make me know that one day I'm going to die." "Tell me why we brought Molly again?" Fraser smiles at her best friend and sister-in-law. "Comic relief," I suggest. "It's one more day we'll never see again," Molly says. "One day closer to our own demise."
"I just think it's prettier than shit," Ike says, pouring a drink over at the bar. "I always noted that white people thought too much." As we feast on the takeout that is far superior to any Chinese food I've tasted in the South, we moan over dishes that we never had until Trevor brought us out to San Francisco in the early 1970s. Niles reminds me that I once outraged the minuscule Charleston Chinese community by claiming that all people of Chinese ancestry forgot how to cook as soon as they crossed the South Carolina state line. This was after my first 2-week visit in Trevor's flat, which served as my honeymoon with Starla. Fraser says, "I'm wearing down. The liquor's good, the vino's great, but we're out here for a reason, and I already miss my kids. Give me a job, Sheba. Tell me what to do tomorrow." Sheba hands us all copies of a long list of names. Her efficiency at this is real, and it's moving. With rare patience, Sheba has waited for the proper moment before she springs into the business side of this hunt. From a beautiful doe-skin briefcase, she hands us each a folder filled with hints and possibilities and rumors that have accrued around the last sightings of Trevor. "Betty and Ike, I'd like you to present yourself to the police department. Tell them what you're doing here and ask them for any assistance possible. Leo is meeting with his columnist friend Herb Kahn. The list contains the names of all the gay men who've been friends or lovers of Trevor's over the past 15 years. Or musicians who've played music with him. Or hostesses who hired him to play piano at their parties. I'd like my junior leaguers, Molly and Fraser, to track down any clues from this list. Let me show all of you something. This is a photograph of the last time I visited Trevor here."
"Did you stay with Trevor?" Ike asks, studying the photograph.
"I'm a movie star, honey," Sheba snorts. "I don't do flats. I do penthouses at the top of the Fairmont." "What a peasant loser you are, Ike," Molly teases. "To think that a movie star would even think about parking her butt in a flat." Sheba ignores Molly. "Remember, Trevor and I haven't been close all these years. He kept in much better touch with all of you. We reminded each other of a hideous childhood we were both in a hurry to forget. I've pinned all of your assignments on your pillows. You've got the necessary maps and the folders. Some of you'll be pounding the pavement for the first couple of days. That's you, boys. One of the worst things about dying of AIDS is that you're penniless at the end. You end up in a fleabag hotel at the end of the line." Fraser gets down to business again. "Who was the last person to see Trevor?" "His doctor at the AIDS clinic in the Castro," Sheba responds. "He told me Trevor had lost 20 pounds in the last 2 years."
"Jesus," Betty cries. "He was such a puny thing anyway."
"Then he dropped off the face of the earth," Sheba continues. "The last time he saw him, the doctor treated Trevor for Kaposi's sarcoma." "Oh no," Molly says. "That's not good. That causes those sores and scales on the face."
"What about Ben Steinberg, Georgie Stickney, or Tillman Carson?" Betty asks.
"They were three of his running buddies when Ike and I were here a couple of years ago." "All dead," Sheba says. "All kids and all dead."
Molly rises from her chair and walks over to one of the extravagant windows that take in the lit-up grandeur of the nighttime city. Her silhouette is forlorn and round-shouldered, looking like one of those helpless witnesses who watch the Passion of Christ play out in those innumerable Renaissance paintings. Our group gathers in quiet solidarity around her. The city glitters beneath us like a prodigious swarm of fireflies. My eye catches the Golden Gate Bridge, which looks like a piece of jewelry linking two music boxes. A stringed trio of architecture, art, and hopelessness all gather up in perfect unity as we hover near our damaged friend. Sheba looks at each of us and says,
"Why don't all of us go Betty by now?"
Ike says,
"I haven't wanted to bring this up, Sheba. I've been waiting for a good time, but there's not going to be a good time. Where's your goddamn daddy?"
I watch as Sheba's face contorts into sudden hatred. Then she catches herself.
"I don't like to talk about that bastard. You know that, Ike."
Ike says, "But you know why I have to ask, and you know why it's important."
I say, "We all got to know about your daddy over the years, and none of us has enjoyed it much."
"If it hurts too much to answer, Sheba," Molly says, "then don't."
Not good enough, Molly, Niles tells her. We've got to know at least where he is.
You're right, Sheba says. Here's the short story. After my graduation from high school, he followed me out to L.A. I didn't know it, but he is brilliant, smarter than anyone. I started working soon as an actress. He found me living in an apartment in Westwood. He raped me. Don't tell us any more, Fraser says. No, the boys are right. All of you need to know. He held me prisoner, did lots of stuff, but no different from when I was a little girl. I learned to dissociate then. I did it again. Then he let me go, went to San Francisco, and did the same thing to Trevor. Next movie, I hired a bodyguard. My dad almost killed that poor man. What name was I to give to the cops? What description? He's used 100 names. Had red hair, gray hair, no hair. Wore beards, mustaches, goatees. Brown-eyed, blue-eyed, green-eyed, turbaned, yarmulke, beret, baseball cap.
Now, where is he now? Ike demands. He's stalked all of us over the years.
He's dead, thank God. He finally made a mistake. 5 years ago, I made that movie in New York. By then, I had enough bodyguards to take on the Secret Service. I was staying at a fancy high-rise. My dad came in disguised as a deliveryman. When he was stopped and questioned by the doorman, Dad killed the man by stabbing him in the heart. An alarm was sounded. He was overpowered. The murder was caught on security tapes. Jack Cross pleaded guilty to murder and was sentenced to life without parole at Sing Sing. He went nuts. Got transferred to a high-security nut house, where he jumped off the roof. End of story. No one knows to this day that Jack Cross was my dad. How do you know? Betty asks. We've got to know this for certain. Jack Cross wrote me from prison, Sheba says. Almost every day. Was that your dad's real name? Molly asks. No, Sheba says. When Trevor and I were born, he was named Houston Poe.
But you're sure he's dead? Niles asks.
I have his ashes in a vase in my place in Santa Monica, Sheba says. I should have said something to all of you before this. I try to pretend he never lived.
To bed, Betty says, and we hug each other good night. Do you mind if I check that story out? Ike asks as he bear hugs Sheba.
Not at all, Ike, Sheba says. But I've got his ashes.
You've got someone's ashes, Ike says. You may even have Jack Cross's ashes. That doesn't mean they're your daddy's.
When I enter my windowless, claustrophobic quarters in the basement, I am pleased to discover good lighting and a comfortable bed and a wall full of carefully selected books. Sheba has typed out my instructions on a piece of heavy personal stationery, and I read them as I undress. 1. Meet with Herb Kahn at 9 a.m. for breakfast at Perry's on Union Street. Sheba will attend the meeting. Very important, he helps us. 2. Go to Trevor's old address at 1038 Union Street and meet the new tenant, a lawyer named Anna Cole, to see if she knows anything about Trevor or his disappearance. Be flirtatious with her, Toad. Use the charm you claim you don't have. Make notes of everything, whether you think it's important or not. 3. Meet the group back at Washington Square Bar and Grill at 1 for lunch and comparison of notes. Your favorite movie star, Sheba Poe. I turn out the lights and climb into bed, into a darkness that seems more than dark, living a life that feels much the same way.
When Trevor first moved to San Francisco, he would tease us poor mortals who were doomed to live out our boring lives in South Carolina. He has always been a conversationalist of rare gifts, and in his first years in the city, he would call and talk to me for hours. I would marvel at his easy command of language and his jeweler's eye for the precise and necessary detail. His first job was as a piano player at a bar called the Curtain Call in the Theater District. To the surprise of none of us, he was a sensation from his first night. The great columnist Herb Kahn authenticated Trevor's success by visiting the curtain call on the first anniversary of Trevor's hiring. He wrote that a young southern wizard has been tickling the ivories and has become legendary for his witty one-liners and flashing repartee. Being written up in Herb Kahn's column was a defining moment in Trevor's career. Trevor sent Herb's columns to me so I could learn how a truly accomplished writer defined his city with wit, sophistication, and flair. The next morning, I walk into Perry's and see that Herb Kahn is already holding court at the best table in the house. He has surrounded himself with a dewy-eyed bunch of low-key sycophants, two ecstatic owners, and tourists snapping pictures of him. His aura creates a swarm of emotion that is something more than hero worship and a bit less than a Zen Buddhist Satori. I have my work cut out for me this morning. Before we left Charleston, I contacted Herb and asked for his help, but now I have to try again to convince him to write a story about Trevor Poe's disappearance and the search party of his high school friends from South Carolina. When he catches me studying him, he motions me to his table. "Sorry I didn't use your friend in Sunday's column, Leo. Not much of a story there, Bubala. We've got thousands of guys dying of AIDS in this city. I spotted six guys with AIDS in this restaurant this morning." "How do you spot them?" I ask. "You'll be an expert in a couple of days. Pretend you're a Russian soldier and you've just arrived at the gates of Auschwitz. That starved, haunted look. That look is a death warrant in this town." "But you remember Trevor Poe," I say. "You've written about him before." "He's a great guy. Funny as hell. Hell of a piano player. But you've got to get me a story. No hook, no story. A gay musician who's got AIDS? Big deal." Seven of his high school friends flew in from Charleston yesterday to hunt for him. One of them's just been named the first black police chief in the history of Charleston. "Nice story. Maybe if I was a cartoonist doing Mary Worth." I laugh and enjoy Herb, as I always did on previous visits. But he goes even further by saying, "You were the best town guide I ever had when I visited Charleston. But I already paid you back for that one. Your story might play in Charleston. It's old news in Baghdad by the bay." "You're right," I say. "Let me buy you another Bloody Mary, Herb, for old time's sake." "You're not telling me something," Herb says. "What do you got? What are you holding out on me?" "It may be nothing. Big guy like you, big city, big names everywhere you look. You don't need anything from a guy like me. I've got to be going now." Herb grabs my arm. "But before you go, I need to know the bone you were going to throw me." "Gotta get it into your column, Herb," I say. "Gotta get a little special attention from you. Otherwise, I fly back south with it." "After all I've done for you," Herb grumbles. "Hell, there's nothing you've got I could use. The best scoop in your life wouldn't make the last line in my column. We play in different leagues, Leo, and you're smart enough to know it." "You're a symphony orchestra, Herb," I say. "I'm an ocarina. I got all that. But I'd never let a story walk out the door like you're about to do. I need you, pal. You're the best at what you do in the country. But I gotta go now, Herb. Enjoy your breakfast." "You'll get one line tomorrow," Herb says. "What you got, Leo? Better be good." "I need a half a column." "You're wasting your time and mine," Herb scoffs. "Bye, Herb. Here's a number where you can reach me." I hand him a piece of paper. "You're playing me. You're actually playing me, greenhorn," Herb says, but with vague admiration. "Tell you what, Leo, half a column. But it better be great. If it's not, you don't get bubkis, comprende?" "I speak many languages, including Yiddish and Italian." "Spill it." Trevor Poe is the brother of the Hollywood actress Sheba Poe. She organized the search. She came to Charleston to ask for our help. "You son of a bitch." "I was taught by a master.
He taught me to always hold a few cards in reserve. Show them the hat, never the rabbit.
How do I know you're telling me the truth? Herb asks.
Two ways. First of all, I give you my word.
Not good enough, Southern boy, he says. Who do you think you're dealing with, a card-carrying member of the Sons of the Confederacy?
I'll ignore your slur on my background.
Herb says, hot air sells balloons, not newspapers.
I remove the perfect stalk of celery from Herb's Bloody Mary and bite off the leafy top of it. With that signal, a woman dressed demurely in a black leather jacket and silk slacks removes her sunglasses. She rises from a table near the end of the bar and unties her Armani scarf. She unzips her jacket and reveals a scant, silvery blouse, as flimsy as a sandwich bag. With a shake of her head, a cascade of golden curls falls around her shoulders. Her stride across the room, however, is purposeful, without the unstudied voluptuousness she brought to every role she played. The entire restaurant is mesmerized by this transformation of a woman who has been sitting in anonymity. The words Sheba Poe pass from table to table as she strides with her green eyes affixed on the appreciative gaze of Herb Kahn.
You got yourself the lead tomorrow, Leo, Herb says as I rise to leave. Done with class and brio, baby cakes.
I would like to introduce you to the legendary Sheba Poe, Herb. Sheba, this is the equally legendary Herb Kahn.
I'll take it from here, Leo, Sheba says. See you at lunch. With perfect timing, she adds, baby cakes.
But to Herb Kahn, she says,
I've lost my brother, Mr. Kahn. I need your help.
I flag down a cab that delivers me to Trevor's old flat at 1038 Union Street on Russian Hill. More than half of his Charleston friends have visited Trevor in his well-equipped guest room that overlooks the everlasting busyness and traffic of Union Street. Trevor exploited his large gift for friendship by sharing his place with anyone who could prove an even tenuous relationship with his core group of Charleston admirers. We paid him back by treating him to overpriced meals in the newly acclaimed hotspots that opened with astonishing frequency in a city that lived for sundown. At the beginning, Trevor force-marched all of us to the Castro to show off the gay community. He took enormous pride in serving as a Southern ambassador to his gay demimonde. The South provided him with both cachet and color commentary. Over the years, he introduced me to so many gay Southern men, from the Tidewater of Virginia to the Arkansas Ozarks, that I thought I could hang their accents out to dry on a clothesline, separated only by geographic idiosyncrasies and slurred syllables of every stripe. Though his high school classmates knew that Trevor had lived in Charleston for only a year before he lit out for the Castro and its unspeakable pleasures, we had to admit he had developed one of the most authentic Charleston accents any of us had ever heard. His brilliance at mimicking had served him well. In his garden one summer, I remember him telling a convivial group of gay men from Chicago,
"The gay men from the South are always the most fascinating members of our tribe. They are the best conversationalists, the most inventive cooks, and they hold their liquor almost too well, I'd say. And they are wicked to the point of criminality in bed. No party in this city is worth its salt without the inclusion of at least one gay man of negligible character and unquestioned provenance from somewhere in the old Confederacy. I've been severely criticized by gay activists with bad breath and British teeth for maintaining my friendship with all my straight friends from Charleston. But they bring me news of that stodgy, asexual world I left behind, where even the missionary position is considered a revolutionary deviation. They remind me that life is a smorgasbord, not just a box of Ritz crackers. And besides, these were my sandbox friends. Metaphorically, of course, but you never desert or dishonor the delicious boys and girls who played in the sandbox with you. Even Philistines from Chicago, with your souls frozen by the winds off Lake Michigan, can understand the power of a friendship that goes all the way back to the sandbox. Or do you Midwesterners make your best friends in snowdrifts?
Then Trevor winked at me with marvelous affection, and I winked back, locked in my colorless, unimaginative straightness. But I could laugh at everything Trevor would say or think or conjure. He always made me and his friends think we were living fuller, richer lives by simply dwelling in his romantic, over-eroticized presence. He made Fraser feel like she was watching a Broadway play, and Molly feel as though she were starring in one. Trevor brought out the protective side of Niles, the maternal side of Betty, the competitive nature of Chad, and the melodramatic part of me. Only Ike looked sideways at Trevor's bravura performances and the accent grated on Ike's sensibility.
"Lose the accent, Trevor. You ain't from Charleston. You ain't from the South. And at best, you sound like a third-rate Negro houseboy," he once told Trevor.
"My accent sounds like the tinkling of an 18th-century chandelier," Trevor replied.
"I've been told that by ladies with the name of Ravenel and Middleton and Prelo, yard jockey."
As the cab leaves me at 1038 Union Street, I have no idea if I will ever see Trevor Poe again or enter this charming space that has meant so much to me over the years. Cars whip by going much too fast. Others jolt past, driven by unsure-footed drivers tapping the brakes again and again, surprised by the steepness of the grade on Union as it makes its incursion into North Beach. I move up to the door and ring the bell, expecting nothing, but putting a southern smile on my face if I am wrong. Sheba has written the woman letters and received no reply. Neither has the new renter responded to a series of phone messages from Sheba's secretary. The renter's name is Anna Cole, and she's a young lawyer from Duluth, Minnesota.
"Anna Cole!"
I shout, calling up to one of the shapely bay windows that look out from the living room.
"I'm a friend of Trevor Poe's from South Carolina, and I need to talk to you. Will you please open the door?"
A nervous but flashy young woman opens the door with unnecessary ferocity and studies me through the space left by a lock and chain.
"What the fuck do you want?"
Anna Cole asks.
"Why are you following me?"
"Ma'am," I say, "I've never seen you before. I'm not following you. My good friend Trevor Poe used to live here, and I'm with a bunch of friends who are looking for him." She looks past me with wild, distrustful eyes.
"I thought you were the pervert who's been tailing me for the past week. What's with the ma'am shit?"
"I'm Southern," I explain. "It's instilled in us at birth. Sorry if it offends you."
"I've always thought the South was the weirdest place in the nation."
"I couldn't agree with you more. But I've never been to Minnesota," I say. Again, I arouse her paranoia.
"How do you know I'm from Minnesota?"
"We did research on the Minnesota chick who got our friend thrown out of his home."
"Look, George Wallace or whatever your damn name is, I'm on edge here. I picked up a bad guy in my life. I've called the cops, but they can't do anything until he rapes me and disembowels me and dumps me into the bay. And I did not get your friend evicted from this flat. He didn't pay his damn rent. How's that my fault?"
"You're right, Garrison Keeler. It's not your fault."
"You're stereotyping me, and I don't like it worth a shit."
"We George Wallaces tend to stereotype ice fishermen from Duluth who stereotype us."
"I shouldn't have said that," she says. "I apologize. Now, please get out of here."
"I need to find my friend," I insist. "I just have a few questions for you, Anna Cole."
"Oh, Jesus."
Her terror is real.
"There he is. He's in that ugly Honda halfway down the street. He's ducked back down now. You can't see him."
She reveals a pistol that she is carrying behind her. She handles it inexpertly, like a girl handling a copperhead for the first time, or a boy for that matter. "Do you know how to use that weapon?" I ask.
"I pointed at his balls, I pulled the trigger, and presto, no balls. How hard can that be?"
"May I borrow the gun, Anna?" I ask with great politeness. "I know how to use one.
But if I succeed in running your friend off, I'll insist you answer some questions about Trevor. She studies me as though noticing me for the first time. Why should I trust you?
Do you trust that guy more?
You could rob me. You could rape me. You could kill me, and the cops would say, "What a dumb fucking broad. She gave him her own gun."
"Yes, ma'am, that's one scenario," I say. "But I think I can get rid of him for you. I have a great imagination."
"How does that help me?"
"Because now we'll find out about your own imagination, if you've got one or not. We'll also find out if you're a good judge of character."
"I don't like your face."
She stares hard at me. "I don't either. Never have."
"I'll be watching from the bay window," she says.
With understandable nervousness, she slips me her small .22 pistol, which I notice is unloaded as I place it in my jacket pocket. I knock on the door again, and she is clearly irritated when she cracks it open. I ask, "Did you buy any bullets for this gun?"
"I don't believe in violence or bloodshed or even the death penalty,"
Anna Cole says with a spiritual certainty I find off-putting.
"What if your pervert kills me? Will you hope he fries in an electric chair or gags to death in a gas chamber?"
"I'd hope he'd get life with no chance of parole," she answers.
"So you think he'd be better off making stop signs and license plates the rest of his life? You think he should take correspondence courses from a community college or enroll in a poetry course taught by some beatnik on Telegraph Avenue?"
"I believe that human life is sacred," she says.
"Garrison Keillor."
"Don't you dare call me that," she snarls.
"My wife is dying of cancer as we speak. Will you promise to take care of my 12 children if they are orphaned in the shootout on Union Street?"
"It won't be a shootout," she says. "You don't have any bullets."
"The pervert may have some. Do you promise to help support my orphan children if they need help?"
"Haven't you ever heard of birth control down south?" she asks, then relents and says, "I promise to do what I can."
"Now, Anna Cole, go to the bay window. Showtime. The latest installment of A Prairie Home Companion is about to begin."
I walk across Union Street and head down the hill, passing the Honda without giving it a sidelong glance. But once I am past it, I circle behind it and write down his license plate number and the fact that it is a brown 1986 Accord. As I write down this general information, I watch the man's head rise up a second time. As I approach his car from the driver's side, he disappears again, dropping all the way to the floorboards along the front seat. When I knock on the window to attract his attention, he lies motionless. I knock harder.
"Sir, open the window. I'd like to talk to you."
"Fuck you, officer," he squeals to the floorboards. "I haven't done anything. This is a legal parking space."
"You're scaring a young lady across the street," I say. "Open the window, sir."
"Fuck you still sounds good to me." "Yep, sounds even better the second time," he says.
I take the handle of the pistol and break a hole in the window. Then I kick the rest of the window in with my right leg, coming at it from an uphill angle. It is a large leg, and the window shatters in an immensely satisfying fashion. I'd once been a Citadel cadet, and I could play the tough guy.
"That's it! Now you're a dead man!"
He brushes shards of glass from his clothes and body. He jerks upright, red-faced and furious, and I take in his plain, unspectacular features as he adjusts his wraparound sunglasses. If I am forced to describe him in a court of law, I'll say his face is modest and plain and functional, just like a Honda Accord. I place the pistol against his forehead, but keep my good humor and wave to passers-by to let them know I have the situation in hand. I remove his sunglasses and deposit them in my pocket. His brows are thick and march above his eyes like one large caterpillar. His eyes are brown, a similar shade as the car, and he is wearing a cheap black toupee.
"Your wallet, sir," I order.
When he gives me his wallet, I say,
"Thank you for your extraordinary level of cooperation, Mr. John Summy."
"Ah, this must be the lovely Mrs. Summy,
and your three handsome sons. And gee whiz, you've been a member of American Express since 1973. And your Visa card's still valid. Though I must tell you, Mr. Summy, you've allowed your Discover card to expire. I'll just keep your wallet for a month or two. By that time, we'll see if you can quit stalking that nice young woman who lives across the street. She's been seeing your ugly mug everywhere she goes. But now that I have your driver's license and know that you live at 25710 Vendola Drive in San Rafael, you might be looking at my ugly mug more often.
I know the mayor personally, he says. I'll have your badge, asshole. You'll be looking at what ads tonight?
Hear that sound? That's my teeth chattering. But you got it all wrong, pal. I'm no cop. I'm that woman's husband. And I just got out of San Quentin. Got your car keys, Mr. Summy?
Yes, sir,
he says. You got any problem with me just letting you go? I promised my wife I'd kill you, but you know how broads are. Sentimental as hell. I'll tell her about your three boys, tug on the old heartstrings. See where I'm coming from?
Yes, sir.
He fumbles with his key, trembling as he tries to insert it into the steering column.
I'll mail you your wallet in a month, I say.
I'd appreciate it.
Now, Summy, we got to make the next part look good for my wife. I'll need your help here. You've got 20 seconds to get out of here. Then I'm going to start shooting at your head. 2 seconds have already passed. I never saw a car outside of the Darlington 500 cover such a distance and such speed. I return in a leisurely fashion to the doorway of 1038 Union, where I once again ring the bell and again hear Anna Cole's strained voice through the locked doorway.
You're a bigger nut than he is, she says.
I can see her outline against the antique lace curtains that had once belonged to Trevor Poe.
He was more difficult to get rid of than I thought, I say.
Why'd you kick out his window?
He refused to talk, and I thought it might get his attention.
Leave. Now, this very moment, or I'll call the cops. You're obviously a lunatic. I don't want to talk to you, and I don't know what happened to your friend. If I did, I'd tell you. Just go.
Okay, I say. Thanks for your help. I turn again and walk down the short flight of steps and back onto Union Street, then hear the door open.
May I have my dad's gun?
She asks. No. You don't believe in bloodshed or violence, remember? By keeping the gun, I'll be helping you live a pious, liberal life. You can't have the gun, nor can you have the stalker's license plate number, nor his wallet, which is chock full of information about his degenerate life. We stand facing each other in a hostile standoff, but she is thinking fast.
Would you like a cup of herbal tea?
No, I would not, I say. Do you have coffee?
I don't like coffee.
I don't like herbal tea, I say. Look, I've got to be going. Here's your dad's gun. Buy some cartridges for it. If that guy's not a sexual pervert, then he's missed his calling. Here's his wallet. Send a copy of the driver's license to the cops.
Would you like a glass of V8 juice?
Yes, I answer. I'd like that very much. I receive a shock when I enter the living room. She has barely changed a thing in Trevor's space. She has placed photographs of her own Minnesota family on top of Trevor's piano, where there had once been pictures of his best friends and the celebrities he met along the way. When I mention to her that she is in possession of every piece of furniture and work of art that once belonged to my friend, there is alarm in her voice as she explains, I didn't steal any of it. I rented the flat furnished, and was delighted to find it furnished by a man of impeccable taste. Why would he leave all this behind? He loved every single piece of furniture, every book, every piece of silver. I've no idea. He was evicted 5 months ago, I think. I've been here for 3 months. He had not paid a penny of rent for over a year. It killed his landlord to evict him, but Mr. Chow felt he had no choice. Trevor never told Mr. Chow he had AIDS. Never even told him he was sick. Mr. Chow broke down and wept when he admitted this to me, and he insisted that I keep all of Trevor's furniture exactly the way it was. It still belongs to Trevor. I'm the caretaker.
Then she asks,
You got a name?
Leo King. I went to high school with Trevor. He was in pretty bad shape when he left here, evidently. The neighbors talk a lot about him. They hate me because they think I stole his apartment.
Where are his photograph albums? I ask. I'd like to take them with me so my friends and I can study them.
She opens a drawer and takes out the albums, then asks me curiously,
Are you married, Leo?
Yes, I am.
You're not wearing a wedding ring, she notes.
My wife wants a divorce. The last time I saw her in Charleston, she stole it while I was taking a shower. I haven't seen her or the ring since.
Children?
I've always wanted some.
Starla never has, I say.
Starla?
Anna says.
What a strange name.
I think it's from the Cherokee language.
What's the translation? She asks. I'm interested in all things Native American.
A strict constructionist would translate it this way. By the shores of Gitche-Gumee.
Another Minnesota joke.
Last one, I promise.
Thank God. Not one of them's been funny. Tell me everything you know about Minnesota.
The Vikings. The Twins. St. Paul's the capital. Minneapolis hates everything about St. Paul, and vice versa. The Mall of America. 10,000 Lakes. Paul Bunyan, Babe, the Blue Ox, Mayo Clinic, Lake Superior, Lampreys, Beaver, Loons, No Poisonous Snakes, By the Shining Big Sea Water, The Wigwam of Nokomis, Canadian Geese, A Million Swedes, Lots of Norwegians, F. Scott Fitzgerald, Lake Itasca, Lake Wobegon, and though I hate to say it because it seems to piss you off, Garrison Keillor.
Not bad, Leo. I'm impressed.
Good. You heard from the gander. Let's hear it from the goose. Tell me everything you know about South Carolina.
Didn't you start the Civil War or something?
She asks with some tentativeness.
Very good. You know about Fort Sumter?
The Research Triangle. Duke University. The Tar Heels.
That's North Carolina, I say.
It's all the same to me. I've never given a shit about the South.
Strange. Minnesota is a constant subject of conversation in southern drawing rooms.
Listen, can I take these photograph albums with me?
Of course.
What about all the other stuff?
What other stuff?
Over 30 boxes. I packed it all up and put it in a storage room down in the garage. His clothes, his personal effects, and his unmentionables.
We'll send for the boxes. What are his unmentionables?
Some of it,
she begins.
What? Some of it is the vilest pornography I've ever seen. I don't care if a guy is gay or not. Hell, I live in San Francisco. But some of that stuff could land you in the federal pen.
Trevor liked his porn. He called it his foreign film collection. We'll pick all that stuff up, too.
I watched some of it. You don't want to carry that stuff across state lines.
We'll take our chances.
Why were you looking at Trevor's porn? Curiosity, she admits. I thought it might turn me on. It had the opposite effect.
It didn't do much for me either. Trevor used to show it to me when I was out here visiting. Told me he was trying to entice me over to the dark side. Then a thought hits Anna, who has the type of expressive face that registers every message she receives from her interior.
Do you know the photograph that Trevor has in the bathroom? Is that Charleston?
Yes, it is. Mind if I look at it while you're getting my glass of V8 juice you promised? I walk down the long hallway before taking a ride into the tiny toilet area, where I see the blown-up photograph of the row of sumptuous mansions that line South Battery Street. The houses glitter in the rich overtones of a perfect sunshot afternoon. He'd always got a laugh from his South Carolina visitors because Trevor would shout to us through the closed bathroom door,
I always think of Charleston any time I find my body urging me toward excretion.
Taking the photograph with me, I walk back into the living room and tell the story to Anna Cole as I drink the V8 that she has spiked with Tabasco sauce and lemon juice.
May I take this photograph, Anna? It'll give a big lift to the people I'm meeting for lunch.
Yeah, sure,
she says, but with some reluctance.
But I'm going to miss it. Which house did Trevor grow up in?
I was going to tell her the truth, but I think that people often need the mythologies they create. He grew up in this one, on the corner of Meeting and South Battery, I tell her.
I knew he came from a life of privilege.
You're right on the money, I say. By the way, Anna, can I write down all the information about your stalker? I'm traveling with two cops, and I'd like them to run it through the system. I copy all the information in his wallet, then thank her for her help and give her our address. If you remember anything that might help us locate Trevor, you can find us there. Sorry about the guy's window. I surprised myself there, and it must have scared you.
I thought you were a nutcase, she agrees. Do you know how weird all this is, Leo?
Tell me.
I've gotten two letters from someone who claims she's Sheba Poe. Also phone calls. But I can tell it's a female impersonator. Can you believe that?
Save the letters. They'll be collector's items someday. I rise to my feet and collect the albums and photograph. Thanks for your help. Here's the phone number and address of where we're staying. Keep in touch, kid. On the walk down to Washington Square, I think about my encounter with Anna Cole and her reaction to me as a Southerner. I never knew how strange a breed of cat a Southerner is until I began to travel around the country. Only then did I learn that the Southerner represents a disfigurement in the national psyche, a wart or carbuncle that requires either a lengthy explanation or cosmetic surgery whenever I would stumble upon the occasional Vermonter or Oregonian or Nebraskan in my journeys. I could grow testy when I met up with folks whose hostility toward the South seemed based on ignorance. I once compiled a list in my column about the reasons people seemed to hate the South, and I invited my readers to add to the literature of contemptuousness a Southerner might encounter on the road. My list was fairly simple. 1. Some people hate Southern accents. 2. Some fools think all Southerners are stupid because of those accents. 3. Some dopes still blame me for the Civil War, though I remember killing only 3 Yankees at Antietam. 4. Many black people I have met outside the South blame me personally for Jim Crow laws, segregation, the need for the Civil Rights Movement, the death of Martin Luther King, the existence of the Ku Klux Klan, all lynchings, and the scourge of slavery. 5. Movie buffs hate the South because they have seen Birth of a Nation, Gone with the Wind, In the Heat of the Night, To Kill a Mockingbird, and Easy Rider. 6. A man from Ohio hates the South because he once ate grits at the Atlanta airport. He admitted that he put milk and sugar on them and thought it was the worst cream of wheat he'd ever tasted. 7. Many women who married Southern men, then divorced them, hate the South, as do any men who married Southern women and divorced them. All men and women who married Southerners, then divorced them, hate their Southern mother-in-laws, ergo the entire South. 8. All liberals based in other geographies hate the South because it is so conservative. They refuse to believe that any true liberals could also be Southern. 9. All women not from the South hate Southern women because Southern women consider themselves far more beautiful than women of the lesser states. 10. All Americans who are not Southern hate the South because they know Southerners don't give a rat's fanny what the rest of the country thinks about them. That column struck such a nerve in the community that I received more than 1,000 letters pro and con. So Anna Cole's reaction to the South was not unprecedented. From his first days in the city, Trevor Poe laid a claim as principal eccentric among the variegated tribe who frequented the Washington Square Bar and Grill. In all of its understated oddity and eclectic decor, it always struck me as a gauzy snapshot of the soul of San Francisco. Because of Trevor's prominence as both a patron and a frequent performer, the place feels like a home away from home for us.
Trevor had been given a window seat to welcome him to the neighborhood, and in many ways, he never surrendered that honorary table as he watched the great carnival of the city pass by in all the fey surrealism that North Beach has to offer. When Leslie Ash, the greatest waitress on earth in Trevor's phrase, came to take his order, he pointed out the windows toward Coit Tower, poised erotically on the summit of Telegraph Hill, and asked her,
"Darling, do you believe Coit Tower is an exercise in phallic symbolism or a literal rendition of an erect penis?"
"I'm just your waitress, honey," Leslie said. "I'll get you what you want to eat and drink. You'll have to hire your own tour guide."
"There's nothing I love more than a witty, unexpected answer from a sassy woman. Can your bartender make me a Bloody Mary I'll never forget?"
"Mike, we got a Rube in town. Wants to know if you can make a Bloody Mary."
"A bloody what?"
asked Mike McCourt, the world's greatest bartender, Trevor's words again.
"Let me look it up in the bartender's manual."
That marked the beginning of Trevor's long association with the wash bag, which became his headquarters, his refuge, and his hideaway from the home he never had. Today, I am the first to arrive. Leslie puts me into a bear hug, then kisses me on the cheek like a sister. Mike McCourt blows me a kiss and makes me a Bloody Mary. The whole restaurant has marked Trevor's sudden disappearance, and all have been worried about both his disease and his whereabouts. It moves me when Leslie brings my Bloody Mary to Trevor's table and motions for me to take a seat. She tells me,
"We'll keep you posted on anything we hear about Trevor. If the little bastard was in trouble, he could have come to live with me."
"You know how cats go off in the woods to die alone," I say.
"Everybody who comes here is looking for Trevor. We've got eyes all over this city."
"Then we'll find him," I say. Soon, the Charleston crowd begins to drift in, and the scene with Leslie and Mike repeats itself over and over. Our group has thrown parties for both of them when they visited Charleston with Trevor in the early 80s, before the AIDS epidemic detonated its quiet poisons through the bloodstreams of an unsuspecting gay population. By now, the newspapers across the Bay Area have become dense and swollen with the obituaries written by the partners and survivors, many of whom carry the virus themselves. It makes me weep to read them, and I always see the face of Trevor Poe in the rawness of the wording. It is a new and terrible literature, delivering an ache of loss and a hopeless mourning over the death of boys. We order light lunches and begin to compare notes from our morning's work. Sheba enters the restaurant in her impenetrable disguise of everydayness, and no one recognizes her. It surprises me that she did not greet either Mike or Leslie, and I let her know that.
"I've never met them," she says. "I've never been here."
"How'd the meeting with Herb Kahn go after I left?" I ask. "It looked like the beginning of something sinful."
"Full-page column, tomorrow morning. Herb's going to tell the story of the famous actress and her high school friends from Charleston who've come to hunt for her brother dying of AIDS. He loved the angle of Ike and Betty being black, Fraser and Molly being society broads, Niles being an orphan, and Leo being a brother columnist." We cheer, but Niles is clearly miffed.
"Why did you have to tell him I'm an orphan? Why didn't you tell him I'm the athletic director at Porter Gaud or teach honors history?"
"Good copy," I explain. "A pathetic orphan boy searching for a childhood friend dying of AIDS? We newspaper guys love hooks." Sheba has grown frustrated by this argument.
"Leo's a hermaphrodite, and Molly's a lesbian whore, and I'm having an affair with President Bush. I just want to find my brother, okay? I didn't mean to hurt your feelings, Niles. You know what we all think about you."
"I have no idea how you think about me, Sheba," Niles says.
"The same thing everyone else does. You're the best of us. The very best, Niles. You've got character that comes from walking through fire when you were a kid. Your sister's a nutcase for the same reason. Me and Trevor are both borderline cases because we didn't do so well in the fire. But you and Betty? The fire made you stronger. It showed your mettle and proved your steel." For the next few moments, we eat and drink in silence.
Then Ike clears his throat and says, "Here's what me and Betty found out. The chief of police handed us off to a cop whose beat has been the Castro for years."
"But Trevor lived on Russian Hill," Fraser says.
"Don't worry," Betty says. "Our boy's well known in the Castro. This cop was fascinating. Told us right off he was gay. Had a dossier on Trevor. In fact, he said they once had a flirtation and he thought it might go somewhere. Trevor admitted he had a thing for guys in uniform."
"I bet that's why he always liked Ike," I say.
"Shut up, Toad," Ike says. "Trevor's been picked up 2 or 3 times for public drunkenness. Got caught once for DUI, paid a fine, had to attend some classes. He was found in possession of pot 4 or 5 times, but that's like being picked up for parsley in this town."
"The most serious thing in Trevor's file is he was picked up once for possession of cocaine with intent to distribute," Betty reads from her notebook. "Again, he was fined for possession, but told the judge he was not guilty. And I quote here, 'Your Honor, I plan to use every damn gram of it for myself.'"
He got a laugh from the judge. "That's our boy," Niles grins. "We called the cop who arrested Trevor for the DUI," Ike says. "Cops are funny. He could have been pissy about it, being called out of the blue and everything. But I explained who we are and what we're doing. He said that Trevor was the most gentlemanly, courtly, and comical drunk he'd ever picked up. Trevor told him, 'Officer, it's men like you who are taking all the fun out of drunk driving. I'd be ashamed of myself if I were you.'"
"Jesus Christ," Fraser puts her face in her hands. "If you had told me when I was 15 that one day I'd be hunting for a sick homosexual who did drugs and had sex with 100 other men, I'd have signed an affidavit that you were crazy as hell." "You were born with a silver service stuffed up your ass, Fraser," Sheba says, her sudden fury silencing us into an abnormal discomfort. "But you were born beautiful, Sheba," Fraser says, shaken. "I'd trade for that any day of the week. Do you think it's made me happy? Do any of you think it's made me happy a single day of my life? Do any of you think of me and say, 'God, I wish I were Sheba Poe'?" "Leave Fraser alone, Sheba," Molly says with an authoritative voice. "And let's hear what Leo learned at Trevor's flat."
I pass around the 4 albums of photographs and mementos, which have turned out to be treasure troves. I see dozens of men I met over the years, smiling through time in the sheer enjoyment of their ineffable handsomeness.
"Jesus Christ," Betty says as she and Ike turn pages. "Is there any such thing as an ugly gay man? These are the best-looking men I've ever seen." "Tell us about Anna Cole," Molly reminds me. "Did you learn anything from her?"
I give an edited version of my encounter with Anna Cole and the lecher she had picked up. Already, I'm feeling sheepish and uncertain about my outburst of machismo. I come up inadequate, if not quite wordless, when I describe my encounter with the beetle-browed stalker. I do not mention the pistol, but I do read out the license plate number, the social security number, and the number on the driver's license of John Summy. I think my exploits will win me a round of well-deserved applause from my friends, but their full frontal assault catches me off guard. "You impersonated a police officer, you dumb son of a bitch," Ike yells.
"You kicked in his window?"
Molly is unable to hide her disgust. "Have you lost your mind, Toad?" Niles asks.
"We'll be lucky if John Summy doesn't go straight to the cops," Sheba says. Fraser jumps in. "How do you know the guy was stalking her, Leo?"
"Because she told me," I explain. "He was lying down on his goddamn floorboards. Why would anyone do that?" Betty rushes in.
"Lying down on his floorboards? I don't know of a statute in a single state where that's against the law. You kicked in his window. Intentional destruction of personal property."
"You're a journalist, Leo," Molly says. "And the News and Courier would fire you if this story makes the local news."
I say, "The hell with all of you. None of you were there. I did the best I could."
"Were you trying to get laid, Leo?" Betty asks. "Was this gal pretty?"
"What difference does that make? I ran the goddamn guy off. The woman's glad, so glad she let me into her flat and gave me these albums. She tells me that she's got 30 boxes of Trevor's stuff stored in her garage, and she promised to help in any way she could.
I think I did pretty well, to tell you the goddamn truth.
You're right, Betty, Molly says in disgust. Leo was flirting, trying to get laid. What is it with you women? Does every damn thing on earth revolve around sex?
Yep, says Betty. The other women nod in agreement.
Niles says, We're operating in strange waters out here, Toad. All of us are in over our heads. We've got to make good, smart decisions. You screwed up, pal, but learn from it. All of us can learn about how not to do it just by listening to how you made a horse's ass of yourself.
Fraser says, directing the attention away from me,
On Monday, we start delivering lunches to indigent AIDS patients for a group called Operation Open Hand. The woman in charge told me and Molly that Trevor probably found himself living on a welfare check and got a room in some squalid hotel, most likely in the Tenderloin. We'll be delivering lunch to the worst dives in the city. She told us we needed to be in the company of some of you guys because it's so dangerous. A lot of times these gay men use aliases to avoid people like us who are trying to find them. So we'll deliver meals to those guys, then interrogate them. We'll get addresses, phone numbers, everything. And sooner or later, we'll find Trevor.
Chapter 15. The Tenderloin. Sunday falls upon us not as a day of rest, but one of drowsy melancholy, or, at best, enforced leisure. Since I was a child, God's day has felt anxiety fraught. The Sunday afternoon willies always leave a handprint on the middle of my stomach. I go to an early mass and get back to a household gathered around the breakfast table. Opening the Sunday Examiner and Chronicle, we turn to Herb Kahn's column and read his piece, The Queen of Sheba. He is as good as his word, and his whole column praises the heroic efforts of the sex goddess Sheba Poe to locate her twin brother Trevor, who has disappeared into that stricken underground world of AIDS. Sheba opens a huge package of circulars that had arrived from L.A., featuring a photograph of Trevor in his dazzling prime that touches me to the core. I hired a Boy Scout troop to put these up all over town, Sheba says. It's a beautiful photograph. He looks just like me, don't you think? Outside, the limo driver honks three times. Murray is going to ride us over to Powell Street, I say. Why don't we just stay around here and get drunk by the pool? Sheba asks. I hate when the Toad makes us go on field trips. It'll be interesting, I promise. What's on Powell Street? Fraser asks. A surprise, I say, but one I promise you'll like. On Powell Street, Murray rolls his eyes when he hears I am forcing my friends to take a cable car ride through the city to Fisherman's Wharf. I think there might be a mutiny among my friends, who groan as they depart the luxurious limo and join a crowd of camera-laden tourists awaiting the arrival of the next cable car. In the storming of the cable car, I barely make it on board, grabbing onto a back railing and hanging on for sweet life. The crowd is high-spirited as our car labors up the hillside. When we reach the summit of Powell Street, I look out toward the white-capped bay, alive with the pretty slippage of sailboats and yachts. But I feel an uncomfortable danger when I realize that I do not have enough room to change hands or find purchase with my dangling right foot on the step I balance on. It is only after we pass through Chinatown, which smells like wonton soup and soy sauce and egg rolls, and begin a headlong dive toward the bay, that I have fears of my bright idea of a cable car ride turning life-threatening. In the middle of the steepest lunge back down the hill, with the cable still humming beneath the streets like some living thing, I hear a woman's voice screaming out in fury. Even worse, I recognize the voice.
Get your goddamn hand out of my purse, you smelly son of a bitch!
The crowd, the gripman, the conductor, and I all freeze. She screams again.
Are you deaf, you worthless bastard? I told you to get your goddamn hand out of my purse and drop my goddamn wallet. Quit pretending you don't know who I'm talking to, bozo. Let me be more specific. Get your goddamn black hand out of my purse.
That narrow it down enough, asshole?
Sheba Poe's voice is as unmistakable as any in movie history. Breathy, sultry, iconic. And at this disturbing moment, unstrung. When the cable car reaches the next intersection, almost every rider leaps off, sprinting in all directions in helter-skelter flight from the drama Sheba has unleashed. The passengers who remain on board have known one another since high school, except for the largest black man I've ever seen. Wild-haired, frantic, 6 feet 5 inches tall, 300 pounds.
"Little woman," he says to Sheba, his voice gently controlled considering the circumstances. "You're going to get yourself hurt if you don't hush your mouth and lower your voice. I can't get my hand out of your purse because you got it so tight around my wrist."
"Let go of my goddamned wallet and I'll loosen the purse, you smelly black son of a bitch."
"I'd lose the references to smell and color," Molly suggests in a soft Charleston accent.
"Uh-oh," the big man says, emboldened. "I believe I found me some cracker girls a long way from home. You cracker girls could get hurt when I pull a knife out of my pocket, which is what I'm about to do to improve Miss Goldilocks' manners."
"You got worse than cracker girls to worry about, Tiger," Betty answers smoothly, pulling out a .38 and laying it against his head. "You got the law." With no assistance from anyone, she goes into professional posture, flipping out handcuffs and passing them to Ike in a move as showy as a behind-the-back pass. Ike snaps them, then steps him off the cable car and into an alleyway as our group follows. The gripman and the conductor appear from where they ducked down in front, as do 6 or 7 curious passengers who materialized out of nowhere. Soon the cable car continues its interrupted journey down toward Fisherman's Wharf, as the 7 of us face the wrath of a man whose eyes are murderous.
"I didn't know you were cops," he says, taking us all in with his wild-eyed gaze and addressing only Ike and Betty.
"We're part of an exchange program," Betty says. I recognize that she and Ike have no idea what to do with their prisoner now that he is cuffed and in their illicit custody. By the looks on their faces, I can tell that what they did was every bit as illegal as the theft of Sheba's wallet.
"You heard that woman call me a nigger?" the man shouts. "It was a racial incident, plain and simple. I'm the victim of a hate crime."
"Shut up, mister," Betty orders. "Give us time to think."
Sheba possesses a gift for making a bad situation worse.
"You're absolutely right, loser. It is a hate crime. I've always hated bastards like you. Look at the size of your ass. Why don't you get a job sawing down redwoods in the National Forest or something?"
For reasons unclear to us, Sheba delivers these words in a drop-dead perfect Charleston accent that only exacerbates the racial tension. I also notice that Sheba has ventured out in her disguise of every woman, with sunglasses, scarf, and loose-fitting clothes, rendering both her frame and her beauty invisible to the naked eye.
"Officers, listen to these white folks," the man says. "These is cracker rednecks. Hell, they're Klansmen for all we know. I know what I'm talking about. I grew up in Carolina. I know a racist bastard when I see one, and I sure as hell know it when I hear one."
"Which Carolina?" Ike asks. "South? Where about?"
By now, all of us have calmed down enough to hear the familiar rhythms of this stranger's voice.
"You ain't never heard of it," the man says.
"Try me," Ike replies.
"Gaffney."
"Gaffney?"
several of us scream. It suddenly hits me when he turns to me that I have seen those eyes before.
"We know this guy," I say in wonder.
To Niles and Ike, I say, "Get rid of the greasy hair, erase the beard. Make him 20 years younger and 50 pounds lighter, pure muscle. The state semifinal in Columbia."
"Son of a bitch, you're right," Ike says in disbelief.
Niles obviously doesn't see it yet and murmurs, "What?"
"Think, Niles, think," Ike says. "We should have beaten Gaffney."
"Why didn't we? We had the better team and were favored to win. Look at those eyes."
"You know South Carolina?"
the man asks with hope.
"Macklin Tijuana Jones,"
Niles exclaims at last, astonished by the recognition.
"We were on their 5,
I remind the women, who are staring at us as if we've lost our minds.
"Down by 6, 58 seconds left to play." "Those eyes.
We drove our fullback into the line 3 straight times, and this was the guy who stopped us each time. The last play, Ike, Niles, and I had the same assignment, to knock this guy out of the play. Our job was to give Wormy a shoulder to get into the end zone. After our last time out, Macklin Tijuana Jones shoved all 3 of us back and tackled Wormy for a 3-yard loss. The last play of the game.
My daddy still thinks you're one of the best 5 football players ever to come out of the state, Ike says. Take off the cuffs, Betty. We got us a homeboy on our hands.
Not till he promises to behave himself, she grumbles.
You guys played for Peninsula? Macklin asks. I kicked the shit out of you.
You sure did, I agree.
Then you played for Georgia.
You played pro, Niles says. But you got hurt. Your knees, right?
Both knees by the time I was finished. The Saints traded me to Oakland. That's how I ended up out here. I was already finished. Ike says, Man, did you go from sugar to shit in a hurry?
I had bad luck, Macklin says. Anyone can have bad luck.
What are we developing here? Skills in the art of conversation? Shoot him in the kneecap and let's go to lunch, Sheba says.
Tell me I didn't rob the wrong broad, Macklin says, which gets a laugh from a few of us.
You've got no clue, my friend, Niles says.
Where do you live now, Macklin?
Betty asks, though she doesn't let down her guard.
In the Tenderloin, he says, in a deserted car owned by a friend. It's parked in the backyard of a building he owns. He was a Raiders fan. Help me out.
You a crack addict? Ike asks. That's what they tell me, Macklin admits.
You a magnificent athlete, Ike shakes his head, then studies Macklin for a long moment. You know the Tenderloin well?
I am the Tenderloin, Macklin brags. It's my base of operations.
You want a job? Ike asks.
Have you lost your ever-loving mind, Ike?
Sheba cries.
No, but I just had me a bright idea, Ike says. Macklin Tijuana Jones is going to help us find Trevor Poe.
That's the dumbest idea I ever heard, Sheba says.
Come on, Ike, Niles says in protest.
This is going to be hard enough, Molly says. Let's try not to make it harder.
What's a soul brother and sister from South Carolina doing hanging around pig honky motherfuckers like these?
Macklin snarls.
That's it, Macklin. Screw up just when things are going your way, I say.
I don't get the Tijuana, Fraser interrupts to ask, speaking for the first time. Is that a family name?
Jesus, I groan. If Charleston were a snake, you couldn't kill it with a stick. My mother's old man was Mexican, Macklin answers her calmly, as if it were the most natural question in the world. My daddy's people were the Joneses.
Ike lets out a bark of laughter at the exchange and says,
Take off the cuffs, Betty. This is a South Carolina Jones.
He still hasn't promised to be a good little soldier, Betty says. He's got to give me a sign.
I'd still like to cold cock that bitch. He looks directly at Sheba.
He must like the handcuffs, Ike, Betty says.
Threaten my friend again, Macklin, Ike says, and I'll take my pistol and break one of your kneecaps. Because I'm a fair man, I'll let you decide which one. I ain't gonna do nothing, Macklin says. Just talking. Always just talking. Shut up and listen for once. In Charleston, Betty and I know the streets, all of them. We know people who can tell us everything. The rumors, the dealers, drug shipments arriving on freighters. But we don't have dog shit in San Francisco. Until now. Now, we've got Mr. Macklin Tijuana Jones. Everybody see what I'm talking about?
Ike speaks directly to each of us.
One thing I know, Macklin says in the quiet that follows Ike's explanation. None of you ain't never seen my black ass again. Nice meeting this interracial pep club, but I'll be on my way if it's okay with you nice folks. If that's your final decision, we'll be on our way, Ike tells him. What about these handcuffs? Macklin asks.
They're yours now, Betty says. They belong to you. Enjoy them.
As a group, we begin walking away from Macklin. He screams,
You can't leave me here handcuffed. We're from the Palmetto State.
Our laughter infuriates him, and he begins cursing us with creativity and panache, which tickles rather than frightens us. The sheer outrageousness of the encounter is taking a giddy toll on all of us. Then Ike spins around and grabs Macklin by the throat.
We need your help, Macklin. Do we get it or not? Be quick, make a fast decision, and try to make a smart one.
Macklin takes it all in, then calms himself.
What can I do for you fine ladies and gentlemen?
Betty turns him around and removes his handcuffs, and Ike says,
Sheba, give me your wallet.
With reluctance, Sheba passes her wallet over to Ike's outstretched palm. He does not take his eyes off Macklin Jones as he removes $300 and presents it to Macklin with a small flourish.
There's more where that came from. We're out here looking for a man named Trevor Poe. He played piano in the city for a lot of important people. Here's a flyer, Macklin. He's got AIDS. You find him for us, and we'll give you $5,000, no questions asked. On the flyer, I wrote down everything you need to find us while we're here. If you want to start your shitty life over again, we can help. Thanks for robbing us today, Macklin. I think God brought us together.
I think it was Satan, he mumbles.
I'll second that, Sheba says, taking off her sunglasses and glowering. Macklin stares at Sheba. They are evenly matched in their capacity to attach hatred to their glaring.
I've seen this twat before,
he says at last, looking away from Sheba to the rest of us.
She was in a Nike commercial or something.
Or something, Sheba says, and we rush to catch the cable car returning down Powell.